This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, this is İlhan Tanır, Ahval's editor. Today, we are going to talk about July 15 coup attempt of 2016. I am joined by two Turkey experts. One is Ryan Cinceras, who is a professor at the Department of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School and is an expert on Turkish and Balkan and Middle East history. He is the author of four books, including the most recently, Eternal Dawn, Turkey in the Age of Atatürk. Welcome to the program, Ryan.
Ryan. Thank you very much for having me. Always nice to talk to you.
And the second guest is Editor-in-Chief Yavuz Baydar. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, İlhan. Hello, Ryan.
Good to see you.
So I'd like to start with Ryan on this. And it's about July 15, 2016. There was a coup attempt on a Friday night in Turkish time and late afternoon in Eastern time. It feels like Turkey's September 11 in a way that everybody whoever is involved with Turkey remembers that day and that night and how the situation revealed that night. I'd like to start from that night. How did you follow the coup attempt, and what did you think of it? And it's a very wide and very complicated question, I know. And if you can summarize Turkey since then, how it changed Turkey, how much it changed Turkey?
Well, it actually took place sort of in the late morning in California time. I can't forget it, probably just like anybody else, because it was such a profound event. I was actually on vacation with my family in San Diego, California, and I followed it via Twitter, I think sort of like lots of people around the world, and was sort of glued to it over the coming hours. Unfortunately, at the expense of my family, who were hoping to sort of enjoy the vacation with me. What did I think of it at the time? I mean, I was sort of stunned by it, mostly for the fact that I think, like the vast majority of people, it came so unexpectedly. It really defied a lot of the ways in which I had come to think about Turkey by that time, specifically kind of the relationship between the military and the government, you know, and was also really bewildered, I think, also, but like many people, by the way it unfolded, the taking of the bridges, the ways in which, you know, these aircraft were used to ostensibly terrorize people, not simply try to cow, you know, civilian authorities into into ceding control, but really terrorize large numbers of people. And I have to say, you know, over the days and weeks that followed, and I could probably say that even now, it's still a really bewildering event, and trying to make sense of it is still really difficult. You know, I think in, you know, now 4 years on, I tend to think of it as a moment that amplified elements of the country's political culture and social culture in really extreme ways. And I think it's the most appropriate way to think about it. I mean, I think that, you know, while there's still so much controversy and lack of clarity regarding the basic elements of July 15th, I think it's very clear that there's a great deal of continuity about regarding events before and events after. Mm-hmm. And I think that that element of continuity is mostly defined by an upward trajectory, by an intensification of different trends. And I think that's the best way to think about it at this point.
It would be fair to say that we don't know much more than what we used to know before, I think, at this juncture, at the fourth anniversary. It is still, as Ryan says, a bewildering, baffling event with a lot of murky corners, dark corners, with lots of question marks hanging above it. I mean, just one point is the dissent or disagreement with which the so-called, you know, coup research commission in Turkish parliament ended. It ended abruptly after the intervention of the then President Erdogan, saying it's over. They don't have to continue anymore. And all three parties in the opposition segment basically offering quite dense series of dissents. This is just one example of how baffling it is still. And I think the background is, again, to concur with what Ryan says, you know, is sort of a threshold in a series of thresholds that really defined the roller coaster ride the AKP rule is actually still is from 2002 on. And I think one threshold was very critical one. I think this was the one to a great deal triggered 15th July, which is the elections in June 7, in 2015, which sort of challenged Erdogan by way of 80 deputies of the Kurdish HDP party entering into parliament. And at that point, I think Erdogan realized that he's on his way to lose his power if it goes on, if the peace process went on, etc. And there was also quite a discontent amongst the generals in the aftermath of that election. We know that from various analysis and reports. And also the 1st of November elections, which was sort of a culmination of a wave of violence, which led to, which frightened really the world, the world of the voters. And then we had this escalation and then ousting of Prime Minister Davutoglu in May, the ending of course, peace process with a very, very murky murder of two policemen, which main opposition party leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu told us in a closed event with the press. He didn't mention off the record, so we discussed it with among us, ourselves, saying that this murder of two policemen was not the PKK's work. So all these series of events that led to what we now talking about. And I think to give another point to end there, all these elements brought together give me a picture of an attempted coup, which was a product of spontaneity and engineering from both sides. I think it would be fair to say that this was known beforehand in Ankara, in Erdogan circles. We have some columns confirming that there were preparations. At least there was knowledge about some sort of coup plotting in the early months of 2016. And then, of course, this coup plotting to a great deal was spontaneous. So both sides, I think, chose this date or were sort of calculating that that there would be a confrontation. Maybe it's a fair picture. I don't know. I'm not sure. But this is what I see at the moment.
Ryan, like to continue this same subject with you after 4 years. As you know, there is a narrative in Turkey by the Turkish administration. It's a coup attempt, engineered and done by the Gulenists, and it's you know, from top to down. Do you subscribe to this theory? And on the other hand, main opposition party leader also talk about this controlled coup attempt, which the saying that this was coming, administration knew that, the president knew that, or the top officials knew that, and it was kind of a wait and see, and when that happens, we'll go after them. So it was all in a way that revealed the way that the administration wanted.
I think the best way to summarize my feelings about this is I don't really have strong, I don't have a very strong opinion about the origins of the coup or its motivations, for the fact that I think that the public is asked to trust conclusions that were made literally as the coup was being enacted, and that subsequent events clearly, in terms of investigations, and in terms of the purges that were enacted thereafter, and in terms of the politicization of the event, you know, to this day, have been made to fit those original conclusions. I would disagree somewhat with the Yabuz about the idea about foreknowledge. I think that it's clear that I think the most confident we can say about foreknowledge is that there was maybe indications earlier that day that there was something occurring. In terms of foreknowledge before, let's say, the morning of July 15th, I'm not sure. I mean, I would say that within Ankara, there is probably a relatively consistent degree of suspicion or rumors about the potential for political instability, whether it's you're talking about coups or terrorist attacks and things like that. And I'm sure that the hum of these rumors may go up, may go down. Things, you know, typically don't happen. So I'm not necessarily, I'm not very partial to this idea that there was a kind of, you know, long expected coup in which, you know, Erdogan waited it out and hoped to use it to his advantage. That's not necessarily something that I'm, you know, 100% prepared to believe, because I don't see a lot of really kind of concrete evidence to that effect. Mm-hmm. In terms of, you know, who I think was behind it and so on, the short of it is that I can believe that Gulenists formed a part of it, that they, you know, comprised the whole of the coup. I don't know. I think it's certainly likely that there may have been lots of different individuals and or factions that comprised it. I would say that what I find somewhat curious is, and still really not explained, is what the coup was actually about, and what it was actually had hoped to achieve, other than to remove Erdogan from power. I don't think I've ever really read or have heard a very convincing explanation to that, you know, to that issue, to that question. And I think that, you know, even with the passage of time, I'm not sure we're ever going to really get concrete answers to any of this.
True. Let me take from there again. There's some question marks, of course. We can always ask questions. And one of the questions is, of course, being a sort of an Islamic sect, let's say, group, Gulenists were far more easier for any kind of secret service penetration than let's say PKK or any leftist organization. It's very easy. You can just start praying in a mosque together with them, stop drinking alcohol, whatever. I mean, it's an easy target to penetrate into. So that's one point. Another point is two columnists, one being writing, I think, in Türkiye Gazetesi, the other one in Sabah. There are three or four columns in April preceding the coup attempt, clearly indicating that there was knowledge, at least in their side, that some sort of assembly in Ankara and Istanbul were happening. And point number three, which baffled me, which still does, in one of the 289 indictments, one about the kazern near Kemerburgaz in Istanbul, the prosecutors are talking about, in a series of, in 4 or 5 weeks, 54 meetings taking place with the officers belonging to that kazern, this kışla, or coming from outside. 54. Mm-hmm. I mean, it must be a really sort of a tin army, or cartoon army management that didn't question what these meetings were all about. If it was 2 meetings, 3 meetings, I would say, okay, fine. This is convincing. But I am really not convinced about the lack of knowledge about just an example of one of these murky sides. And the fourth point, I think, I want to hear Ryan's analysis about this is the very choreography of this coup d'etat, which tells us this, more or less. On colonel level or lieutenant colonel level, up to one-star generals, we see the main bulk of the putschists. Then you go to 2, 3-star, 4-star generals, which they may have taken side earlier or not, or that they must have stood firm. They are not really affiliated with the directly with the coup at the attempt. And then you have these sort of majors, etc., lower ranks. But overall, I think 5 to 7% of the army took part in that action that night. It's very low level. But yeah. I think we can talk about ranks, involvement of ranks. You know, we talk about when we talk about Greek coup, for example, we talk about or Gaddafi coup. This is colonel's coup. So what confirms this involvement or domination of the Gülenists segment in that is that, of course, there were new upcoming officers affiliated directly or indirectly with the Gülen section. But then there are others as well, who had nothing to do with the Gülen movement at all. But overall, the result is the immediate purge of almost 47% of the general segment. Generals, one to four stars. So it's baffling in many ways. The cause and effect side, if you put them together, many things are baffling.
Just to follow up, sure. I mean, I think, I don't disagree that, I mean, there were signs. I mean, there is this famous piece that Michael Rubin wrote in advance, which a lot of people, point to as being evidence of foreknowledge, evidence of some sort of American complicity in it.
Just to interrupt you, there was a piece by Gönül Tol in, was it Foreign Affairs, Ilhan?
Yes, Foreign Affairs.
I think it was 2 months
ago. A month ago. Yeah,
it was clearly speaking about some sort of, anti-Erdogan military mobilization from within the army. So not only Rubin, many others.
Right. So what I struggle with, and it's the same thing with the example you brought up with respect to the meeting, that you cite, is context. I don't know how often such rumors occur. I can't place a meeting, meetings within the Turkish officer corps within context of sort of their usual behavior. I don't know. And I think, I'm relatively small C conservative when it comes to trying to write or venture my opinions about Turkey, because I think that there is usually a tendency, especially with sort of major events where the details are murky, to kind of hang your hat on single items of evidence and try to sort of speculate from there. And I if you were to tell me that, you know, 4 months out, there were consistent and very clear signs of a coup, and that this was something being monitored and cultivated, and that and not only was it anticipated that that Erdogan and sort of his circles were planning on it in order to pounce and take some sort of advantage of it, can I believe it? I don't know. I suppose I could believe anything, but I would have trouble believing it based on the evidence that I've seen so far. That said, I would, you know, I think that I don't want to confuse necessarily events, you know, sort of suspicions about events before with the really concrete events that occur after. The really concrete events that occur after are purges. And the purges seem to me in line with a broader tendency that was already going on in the country at that time, which was the cleansing of the state of any and all suspected elements or individuals who were deemed threatening. And I think, you know, that's why I would associate July 15th as an event that amplified previous trends, as opposed to something that, you know, sort of a rupture that led to new trends. And I would sort of just, as a last point, I mean, this is, it's clear that lots of different types of people fell victim to the purges thereafter. Individuals who did not necessarily have anything to do with the coup whatsoever. And I think the example that I would point out, and it's something that's been sort of documented within the Turkish press, and it's something that, you know, I'm somewhat familiar with, are officers who were educated in U.S. military institutions. And it's clear that that, as a group, was specifically targeted. Now, begs the question, why? You know, do I believe that it has totally to do with any kind of complicity in the coup attempt? Most probably not, and more probably it was, you know, part and parcel also of a broader attempt to begin to, you know, cultivate a new strata of officer within the military that was more ideologically or professionally to the liking of senior civilian officials.
Yes, and also the question remains, and I pointed out already, why up to 48% of the generals immediately were victimized by this purge, many of whom absolutely had nothing to do with the claims that they were affiliated with Gulen movement, Gulen group. So clearly, and I agree, this should be taken as a point of analysis for what happened afterwards. We also know what happened concretely that night.
Yeah.
And also, some parts of it in Ankara is murky, but one question mark again being why those skillful Air Force pilots did miss Parliament or Palace. They only bombarded the margins, the sides of these two major targets, which could not be missed. But again, coming back to that night, I think one memory of shame, I think, is the massacre that took place on the bridge against these order-taking soldiers who had absolutely no idea probably what they were gonna called for outside, and also the lynching and also the sentencing of the cadets of Kuleli. The latter got lost in the myth building, and they were still they are still labeled as enemies and traitors, etc., and their families still cry out in vain. There seems to be no way of rescuing these youngsters, 17, 18 year old, 19 year old cadets, who were used, I think, one way or another, as pawns, for the conclusion of that night. I think I will go in a little bit to what the consequences of or repercussions of this coup attempt was that night. There seems to be a continuity, as you say, Ryan. The lists of the to be purged, judicial, the judges and prosecutors. It was already read out loudly that night in television. It seemed to confirm that there was premeditation, one way or another, and those were also victimized. And I think the management in the post-coup attempt situation, management by Erdogan, was extremely skillful, and the assembly in Yeni Kapı pushing the main opposition to a corner. And basically leaving no alternative, no option but to joining his party on the stage at that night, at that day in Yeni Kapı, was a result of extremely skillful political engineering, and as part of the myth building that followed, which was sort of fed with the lots of rhetoric that Erdogan used as baits for all these social and political groups which hated the guts of the Gülen group. And he was able to unify the extreme left, Turkish left, and large segments of Kurds, etc., and perhaps blurred their foresight or predictions, these groups, that they would be next targets, next victims. As soon as the state of emergency came, people were unable to understand what the state of emergency meant for them. I think general belief in the following weeks was, okay, we know who was behind this coup and who the target is, and we will be spared, which didn't happen, which only happened in a contrary way.
Yes, after the coup attempt, about 2 years, Turkey was managed by state of emergency, in which Erdogan won two critical elections, one that he changed the system of Turkey, then he became the president. Ryan, looking at from here, 2020 of July, going forward, with all the troubles Erdogan is facing, how it's going to go from here now that the economy is tanked and there is a erosion of support in Turkey, and the effects of the coup is getting older. It has been 4 years now. People are looking out for new things. There are new parties coming from Erdogan's party. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel for Turkey?
I think the point you raise more specifically about, the fact that 4 years on, the coup does feel like it slipped more into history. I think it's an interesting point. And I can be convinced that that's the case for large numbers of voters, as well as large numbers of people who are in positions of authority or have power, not just people, with political power, but, people who are leaders of industry, people who are, who work within the media and so on. I think I have trouble sort of speculating sort of long-term trends in Turkey. Even before 2016, there were signs that Turkey's economy was in trouble. And over these last 4 years, I've been really pessimistic, for example, about not simply the Turkish economy, but the effect that it could have on Erdogan's hold on power. And here we are in 2020. Economy is obviously, quite bad. I think one of the lessons I think I've learned over the last 4 years is not to be too confident about the political relationship between economy and Erdogan, as if economy goes down, Erdogan will weaken and be made vulnerable to attack. My sense, just in general, is that the administration in Ankara goes from week to week. I mean, I don't know if there's necessarily a kind of long-term strategy about how Erdogan intends to get out of, you know, the economic crisis, how he anticipates running for president necessarily down the line. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, Ankara's behavior is still very reactive. That said, you know, if you're asking me, can I offer some sort of positive, you know, note on this occasion, I take some solace in the ways in which I think a lot of young people have reacted over the last 4 to 5 years. Erdogan has staked obviously so much on using national education system, using, you know, religious institutions to try to mold and shape the opinions of young people. And young people have proven really stubbornly resistant, it seems, to this trend. And, you know, this in light of the fact that, you know, large numbers of people, young people, experienced the events of July 15th firsthand. And so the fact that I think we've seen some degree of exhaustion or disillusionment with young people in Turkey, I think is among the more, you know, positive signs of something that I think perhaps would bode well for the future. I mean, beyond that, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't take a gamble to try to speculate, you know, what else to expect.
Brian, I'm interested in hearing what one point which sort of puzzles me in certain ways. I think one thing is clear also in post-attempted coup period, be that within state of emergency or be that afterwards, we see clearly immense changes in power structures of Turkey in terms of consolidation of, again, the old Grey Wolf segment, pillar, and also Eurasianists, as they are called, you know, unifying with Islamists. In some ways, this reminds me of early 1990s in Turkey. Mm. But also, another part of it is that, you know, the story of Erdogan's AKP rule in Turkey up until the attempted coup was a tug of war with the army. With the army top management, and the July 15 attempted coup was a very sharp turn with the purge and everything. Do you think Erdogan, in a way, managed to pass some sort of major threshold in order to make these changes in this Turkey once very powerful sort of tutelary army management to irreversibly to his favor? Mm-hmm. And also in terms of, this is one, and second one is, are these power structure changes in a way permanent or very, very long term? Because we can, if we will, see these changes as part of the culmination towards the centennial of Turkish Republic, because sure. Erdogan has his ideas about it, very clear. Bahçeli does, and some of the ex-generals, ex-officers have seem to agree. How do you see these two points?
It's a really great. I mean, these are really great points, and they're great questions. I think that, you know, there were signs before 2016 that the MHP right was at the very least elements of its program were being appropriated by Erdogan and the AKP in general. I mean, we see it in rhetorical signs, and it's certainly, you know, I think there was a clear indication before 2016 that the Kurdish opening was a gambit that was not paying off for AK. And so I think the consolidation of AKP alongside MHP is both, I think, an expression of the ways in which the two have become ideologically much more conjoined, but obviously, too, the two are hostage to one another in electoral terms. So now, I don't know, I'm not necessarily very confident to give an answer of what came first. Was it ideology, or was it simply, you know, a question of, you know, of an alliance of convenience that helped create this kind of merger between the two parties? But I think among the things that 2016 affirmed is that the rhetoric and the imagery that Erdogan promoted thereafter of this kind of fedayeen type, you know, warriors for the Turkish state, defenders of Erdogan and you know, sort of the those who would, you know, who, you know, would sacrifice themselves in the name of protecting, you know, the AKP's government and the Turkish state itself. I think that image blurs very nicely between the MHP right and the AKP. I think it's something that is not just sort of effective, but I think both find very gratifying. With respect to the military, you know, I'm really hesitant to sort of, you know, offer strong opinions about the way the military has changed since 2016. And I think one thing that really obscures it is the role of Hulusi Akar. Hulusi Akar, I think we can say, you know, confidently has now rebuilt the military in a way that suits him personally in terms of placing in roles of authority people that he prefers, not simply because they necessarily are qualified, but people who are perhaps more dependent upon him, more pliable, more politically acceptable, what have you. I think beyond that, I find the reconsolidation of the military continuing to be somewhat of a puzzle. And a part of it is this question of to what degree is the military being altered in ideological terms? I mean, you referenced, for example, you know, the prevalence perhaps of Eurasianists mm-hmm. within the ranks of not simply, you know, the rank and file of the military, but among senior leadership. I think this is one of the things that the demotion and resignation of Cihat Yayaci makes really somewhat difficult to evaluate. Mm-hmm. Is his resignation a sign that as a political group they were strong and now they're getting weaker, or they're being sidelined, or are we perhaps, you know, maybe overvaluing ideology as much as perhaps this is a question of personality, and that this was somebody who was who had gathered a great deal of status within Ankara and within society at large, and that as an individual he was simply too influential to kind of keep within, you know, within the ranks, or at least sort of having continued to rise higher. So I think that, you know, what we'll eventually, I guess we'll find out is once, you know, the AKP administration comes to an end, however it comes to an end, we'll find out how much of these changes were permanent, to what degree these, you know, the changes that were happening institutionally reflected ideological shifts, how and to what degree personalities played, let's say, an overemphasizing role within any kind of changes.
Thank you. We cannot hear you, to Ilhan.
Yeah, you're on mute.
You're on mute.
Okay, I just want to make sure that there is no noise coming from here. Thanks so much for this very insightful and very interesting and thought-provoking insights from you on coup and how Turkey has been changing and how the purge mechanism has been engineered since then. And if you'd like to add anything on at this point, Yavuz Baydar, you can go ahead. Otherwise,
no,
I'm going
I think
to
I will
close
end by
this.
Saying I will end by saying that as ever, this interesting story continues, and I think we will really have to look with great focus and interest on what will happen. Again, in post fourth anniversary, July 15, and the coming weeks and months, I think this is a continuing story until 2023. These actors are all very interesting, and unfortunately, the underdogs, the victims of this 4 years, are there. You know, this KHK, these dispersed people. Unfortunately, transformed into what Goebbels used to call, you know, walking dead or living dead or civilian dead, and also those nearly 50,000 political prisoners, whose overwhelming majority have apparently no idea why they are in prison, and except for a few. So this story will continue again until the centennial, to say the least. And we will have again occasion or reason to come back to this subject, hopefully with Ryan again.
And hopefully we'll know more about the coup, details of the coup night, because there are so many unknowns.
Maybe never.
On that night. What happened at the Akıncı Air Base, how it developed, because we don't see the footages. Footages are missing from the Akıncı Base, or there are people who played very important roles at that night, and they never went to neither the commission at the parliament nor any trials to talk about what they have seen, including the General Chief of Staff. And the head of the intelligence service that night, and also there are a couple other very important actors on that night, never talk about it, never shared their experience, and the whole world is still in dark in many on that many points. Thanks so much for coming on tonight, and hopefully we'll continue to talk about this in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ilhan. Thank you, Yavuz.
Thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Ilhan.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.